What is the most important e-discovery issue today?
Cost control?
Technology-assisted review?
Information management?
Preservation?
From the latest cases to the newest technologies.
Our goal is to expose legal professionals to the most important e-discovery trends
with the brightest e-discovery experts.
Rulemaking,
predictive coding,
litigation hold,
proportionality,
document review,
social media,
efficiency,
ethics,
cooperation. Welcome to the ESI Report, sponsored by Kroll On Track, an e-discovery software and service provider. You are listening to the Legal Talk Network.
Hi, I'm Michelle Lang, and welcome to the ESI Report. Today, I have two industry experts joining me to talk about one of the most recognizable names in e-discovery, Shira Shinlin. Judge Shinlin has built quite a reputation for herself in the e-discovery world, and recently she decided SecuSui American Corp versus Hart, which was significant in that it overturned a finding of another noted e-discovery judge, Magistrate Judge Frank Maas. My guests today, Adam and Catherine Losey, are also notable e-discovery enthusiasts. Adam is an attorney at Foley & Lardner, president and founder of ITLEX, and the recipient of the prestigious 7th grade Most Improved Behavior Award from Maitland Middle School. Catherine will be joining the firm of Littler Mendelsohn in October to become a member of the firm's e-discovery practice group. As a side note, Catherine wants everyone to know that she won her middle school's Best Dressed Award, which is not nearly as prestigious as Adam's Most Improved Behavior Award from his middle school. Adam and Catherine are both double Gators because they both went to University of Florida for undergrad and law school, and they're coming to us from Florida today. Adam and Catherine, I'm so happy you could join me on the show.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
Hi, Michelle. This is Catherine. Glad to be a part of the show today.
So before we dig in on the SecuSui opinion, Adam and Catherine, maybe, Adam, you could just give us a little bit of an update on what's going on at ITLEX and perhaps just a little bit of an intro as to what ITLEX is for folks that aren't familiar.
Sure. ITLEX is a 501c3 not-for-profit organization that I started last year with the support of a lot of folks in the e-discovery community, folks in private practice, a lot of law professors, and some federal and state court judges. And we do a lot of things. We do two-a-day blogs on technology law issues. We have a big cash prize writing competition for law students that will be opening again in a few months. So any law students, or if you know any, let them know about the site. But the latest and greatest is October 17th and 18th. We're having our first inaugural conference, the Innovate Conference, where the Chief Privacy Officer of the Federal Trade Commission, the head of Google's eDiscovery Department, folks from the FBI, Judges Fasciola, Nolan, all the Loseys, and I'll stop dropping names, but a lot of good folks are coming to the conference. So if you happen to hear this beforehand and you'd like to come, please check out the site, and we'd love to see you there.
Sounds good. So let's go ahead and dig in a little bit. Catherine, to build a background for the case we're talking about today, can you provide listeners with a bit of an e-discovery history lesson with regards to Judge Shinlin and her seminal e-discovery opinions?
Sure, Michelle. Well, she's really been a fixture in the e-discovery world since she issued the series of Zubu Lake decisions, and the last of which came out in 2004. Now, those decisions were really groundbreaking because they were issued prior to the 2006 amendments to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, and they covered a wide range of issues ranging from scope of duty to preserve ESI in litigation, a lawyer's duty to monitor his or her client's compliance with ESI preservation and production, and cost shifting. So then another famous and controversial opinion that came out later on was the Pension Committee decision that was issued in 2010. Now, this case is really notable for tackling litigation hold notices, and one of the more controversial requirements that came out of that case was that litigation hold notices should be in writing. Otherwise, it would be considered gross negligence, per se, on the attorney's part. Now, other courts have not uniformly adopted this view. Her next major e-discovery decision was National Day Laborers, where she held that the federal government must include metadata in Freedom of Information Act productions, and that certain key metadata fields are integral to public records. That opinion was later withdrawn, but nonetheless, it's still an important decision for laying out the integral metadata fields for ESI. And that's really the major decisions from the judge.
So let's fast forward a little bit to today and talk a little bit about Judge Shindlin's most recent e-discovery opinion. Catherine, maybe you can give us some background on the Sekisui case and its procedural posture when it came to Judge Shindlin.
Sure, Michelle. I think the best way to sum up the factual background of this case really is to go to what the magistrate judge put in his opinion. And I'll quote from that. He said that this case arises out of a corporate marriage gone bad. So basically what happened here is the plaintiffs acquired another company controlled by the defendants Richard Hart and Mary Louise Trudel Hart. It's called America Diagnostica, Inc., or ADI. And that company was engaged in marketing and manufacturing medical diagnostic products. Richard Hart was its president, and after the acquisition in 2009, Hart remained on with ADI as its CEO. So about a year and a half later, the new owners became disenchanted with the company, and on October 14th, 2010, the new owners fired Hart and provided him with what they called a notice of claim, concerning likely claims for damages they would be making against him in the future, potentially. The actual complaint against Hart and his wife, however, wasn't filed until about a year and a half later, on May 2nd, 2012. Although one of the plaintiff's companies terminated Hart and sent both Hart defendants a notice of claim, the company failed to implement a litigation hold until January 31st, 2012, which was more than 15 months later. Additionally, the outside vendor managing ADI's computer operations was not told that there was a need to preserve the relevant ESI until July 26, 2012, which was nearly 3 months after the lawsuit was filed. So in the interim, around March and October 2011, ADI's human resources manager authorized the outside email vendor to erase the email folders of several ADI employees, including Richard Hart. The reason given for the alleged destruction was that there were storage availability issues with keeping all the email. Now, prior to that destruction of Hart's email, the human resources manager did print out some emails that she thought would be pertinent to the company. So later on down the road, the lawyers for the plaintiffs undertook to recreate Hart's email from other sources after they got discovery requests, including other employees, the printouts done by the human resources manager, and the email server, and so on. So they went and sought those emails from alternative sources. And from these alternative sources, they were able to recover about 36,000 emails from Hart's email. And the second relevant employee that was involved, whose emails were destroyed, they were able to provide about 7,000 emails. So defendants requested sanctions for the willful destruction of the email, including an adverse inference instruction. That dispute was then referred to the magistrate judge, who reviewed the situation and found that plaintiff's conduct, while may have risen to the level of gross negligence, was not by itself enough to entitle the defendants to sanctions. So after the defendants objected to the magistrate's order, Judge Shindlin reversed the denial of sanctions and imposed an adverse inference instruction and monetary sanctions.
So, Catherine, just a little bit more about the case. What grounds did Judge Maz and Judge Shindlin disagree? So the magistrate judge and then the federal judge, what grounds did they disagree with regards to the facts?
Well, there were several grounds of disagreement, but they disagreed most strongly on the relevance and prejudice issues. As to relevance, the district court indicated that willful destruction is sufficient to allow the conclusion that the missing evidence was unfavorable to the party who destroyed it, and that grossly negligent destruction would also suffice in some circumstances. On the other hand, the magistrate found that the defendants had not shown that relevant information potentially helpful to them was no longer available because of the destruction. Finally, as to prejudice, the district court reasoned that when evidence is destroyed willfully or through gross negligence, prejudice to the innocent party may be presumed. And the court went on to note that a case-by-case approach was most appropriate and that the failure to adopt good preservation practices was one factor to look at. Now, the magistrate, on the other hand, had found that the defendants had not established prejudice.
So, Adam, when it comes to meeting the sanctions for spoliation, is there a similar opinion with regards to courts across the country, or is what's going on here in this case something that's simply confined to the Southern District of New York?
No, you see it across the country. I mean, within districts, between states. It varies from judge to judge, and that's a big part of the issue in these spoliation cases is reasonable minds differ. Judge Shindlin and Judge Master, both very, very intelligent people, and both had different well-reasoned takes on the same issue. And anytime you're looking at a spoliation issue, you've got kind of a subjective ex post facto determination by a judge as to what was reasonable as to the amount of prejudice, which is often kind of the rub in these cases, is showing what degree of prejudice you've suffered. And people just differ in their opinions. And the standards are such that they're flexible, and that a judge's judgment, really, about these issues is often dispositive on whether someone is sanctioned or not, on the severity of the sanction, and people are different across the country. Certainly, there are regional differences, and that in my experience, I've found that in New York, for example, a litigant may be cut less slack in failure to be prompt in implementing litigation holds than opposed to, say, like a state court in Georgia or Alabama. But you never know. I mean, it largely depends on the judge that you have. And the lesson from that is that you've just got to plan around the most stringent standard and the judge that's going to have the least tolerance, because you can't control where you get sued in many cases. And I've even seen people in negotiating contracts and choice of venue clauses and what law will apply, you know, talk about these issues and preservation, because certainly a lot of companies feel like in certain jurisdictions, they're held to a different standard than others.
So let's talk a little bit about the implications of this opinion by Judge Shindlin. What do you think with regards to the future should organizations take away?
Well, the first thing is she backed away a bit from the failure to timely institute a litigation hold, equating potentially to gross negligence per se. And Kat referenced that a while ago, and anybody that's seen a scary e-discovery PowerPoint has probably seen the quote from Pension Committee, where I believe the language was the failure to issue a written litigation hold in a timely manner amounts to gross negligence. And the Second Circuit was addressing, I believe it was the Orbit One case with Judge Francis, and said, no, not necessarily. We reject the notion that a failure to institute a litigation hold constitutes gross negligence per se. And then they kind of compared the Pension Committee case, and they said, well, we agree the better approach is to consider the failure to adopt a good preservation practice as just one factor in the rubric of factors and whether you should sanction or not. And she cited that opinion and backed away a bit from the per se gross negligence standard. So that's one big thing. The other is, you see the case involved an outside vendor, NCS, and there was a common mistake that a lot of litigants make is not really looping in outside vendors that are managing data and not paying attention to it. And they actually did a pretty good job. Before they deleted emails, they repeatedly asked the company, according to the opinion, are you sure? Are you sure you want us to delete it? So it seems like, you know, your classic spoliation case where someone just completely misses the issue. It's also good precedent against the cobble together defense for email deletion, and I should define the cobble together defense, but when an email account gets deleted, frequently a defense is, well, email's a communicative medium, and sure, we deleted the account of Adam, but Adam was communicating with Beth, Carol, and Dirk, and we've gone through Beth, Carol, and Dirk's accounts, and we've recreated the account for Adam, and that's something they kind of tried here. And Shindlin didn't think that was enough to overcome the prejudice. And then the last takeaway is just with prejudice. Again, that's the big rub in litigating spoliation, is proving prejudice. And she talks about, you know, gross negligence being enough to presume prejudice. And that goes back to Armory v. Delamire. That goes back to, you know, arguably a 1722 case about, well, you know, if you had a duty to preserve it and you lost it, it's on you. But then if you have negligence, you don't get the presumption, right? So the negligence and gross negligence distinction is very, very subjective, I think, in some ways. And it makes it difficult to really figure out where someone falls, because to one judge, you know, certainly issuing a written litigation hold not doing that might be grossly negligent. To another, it might be negligent. And to a third, there might be nothing wrong with that at all if it's oral.
So, Adam, Judge Shindlin also took the opportunity to comment on the future with regards to proposed changes to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, specifically Rule 37E. Could you talk for just a minute about what Judge Shindlin said in this case with regards to future FRCP amendments?
Yeah, and this is in, I believe, footnote 51 of the opinion. And she brings up that if you adopt what's in 37E, 37E currently is the safe harbor, and it's very short. And the proposed changes have a much longer, more robust rule where you could only get sanctions if destruction of evidence, one, caused substantial prejudice and was willful or in bad faith, or two, irreparably deprived a party of any meaningful opportunity to present or defend its claims. And this is a direct quote. She does not agree that the burden of proof prejudice from missing evidence lost as a result of willful or intentional misconduct should fall on the innocent party. So she doesn't agree necessarily with those changes. And an interesting thing that I don't believe she brought up in this opinion, but which has kind of piqued my interest with the proposed rule changes, is that spoliation is actually a substantive cause of action in certain states. In Florida, for example, it's not foreclosed, and there's a footnote in a Florida Supreme Court opinion that suggests that there may be a cause of action against the non-party for spoliation, and some states do have it. A lot of people don't know this, but federal courts sitting in diversity have frequently disagreed on whether issues of spoliation are substantive, you know, a matter of state law, or if they're procedural, meaning, you know, federal common law presumably applies. And so the proposed federal rule may well have some interesting interplays with state law that is different and, frankly, a lesser standard. So I'm kind of curious about the constitutionality about that and how that'll play out.
You know, it's definitely a lot of unanswered questions on the horizon, but something we'll all certainly want to stay tuned to. So, Adam and Catherine, thanks for the scoop on this interesting and timely opinion. And if you're willing, I'd like for you to stick around for a little bit of technology law humor, if you're game. We want to call it the eDiscovery Newlywed Game. Sound like fun?
Sounds good to me.
Sure, I'm up for it.
So we won't beat around the bush. You guys were newly recently married in the last couple of years, and so we want to ask you a few questions. Take a play from the original Newlywed Game, asking you to describe your marriage with an eDiscovery twist. Adam, perhaps you could go first. If you could describe your marriage in a keyword search using Boolean connectors, what would it be?
That's a tough one. How about open quote, Adam is lucky, end quote, and open quote, what is Kat thinking, close quote, within five of wonderful and not boring? And then we'll see what that pulls up.
Catherine, what do you have to say about that?
I disagree because I think I'm very lucky to be with Adam. So I disagree on the first part, but I do agree with the wonderful and boring part of it, or not boring part of it.
And something you have to keep in mind, too, is Kat has very poor vision, which is how I got her to agree to go out with me in the first place. So
not true. My vision has been corrected with contact.
So, Catherine, how about a question for you? What eDiscovery best practice, principle, or rule would you also consider important in creating a successful marriage?
Well, I think that one's pretty easy, actually, and that would be cooperation, because cooperation is really the foundation for a good marriage. You have to go back and forth, make compromises, talk to the other person, work things out. And same thing with e-discovery disputes. If you have the ability to work with the other side and cooperate on issues, it can make for a much smoother litigation than if you don't.
And Adam, how about one more question for you? What would be the ideal file format to produce your wedding certificate if it was subject to litigation?
By the way, Kat's answer was much better than mine. I'm jealous of her answers. Well, we got married in Savannah, and it's a Georgia marriage license, so I don't know the Georgia rules, but I always like electronic. So I'll say in its, actually its native format would be paper, I believe, wouldn't it, Kat?
Yes, native format would be paper, actually. Or at least that's the way we got it in the mail. We got it in paper format.
Well, no one can have that. So if we're not a party, they'll have to get I don't know, they'll need an order if they want the original. Otherwise, I'll give them a copy.
Perhaps give them a copy of a native, a PDF or a TIFF image?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the PDF wouldn't be native, would it? Because the native would be the paper, so we could scan it, and I will send them a copy. Heavily redacted, of course.
Adam and Catherine, thank you for adding a little bit of humor to the day and to our podcast. This was fun. Thanks for enlightening listeners, most importantly, on the recent eDiscovery case law updates.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Finally, thanks to everyone listening to this edition of the ESI Report, and thanks to Kroll OnTrack for sponsoring another show. As always, if you're a social media wonk, check out theediscoveryblog.com. That's theediscoveryblog.com. And don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Michelle C.S. Lang. Until next time, I'm Michelle Lang, signing off for the ESI Report.
This was another edition of the ESI Report, sponsored by Kroll OnTrack. Be sure to follow Kroll OnTrack on Facebook and Twitter, or learn more about Kroll OnTrack's software and services at www.krolontrack.com. Thanks for listening to the ESI Report, produced by the broadcast professionals at Legal Talk Network. Join Michelle Lang for her next podcast on the latest e-discovery trends. Subscribe to the RSS feed on LegalTalkNetwork.com or in iTunes. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, Legal Talk Network, its officers, directors, employees, agents, representatives, shareholders, and subsidiaries. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer.